Let's jump into our virtual teaching session. Welcome everyone to the Strategy Division Teaching Virtual Workshop. My name is Deepak Somaya. I'm the division chair-elect this year, and it's my pleasure to oversee the teaching-related activities, including the teaching committee. Thank you for being here, and I should also thank all the volunteers of the division for their work, because without that, we couldn't possibly be running the division. And in particular for today, I want to thank Jenny Kwan and Nathan Furr, who've been just amazing in putting together this workshop, but also someone who is not here, who's Juan, and Juan Santalo had another conflict this time, and so he kindly allowed us to have it at this time in spite of his conflict. So thank you, Juan, as well. And very quickly, also, I would like to thank Louise Moores, who's our division chair, who's been really helpful in organizing this and giving me lots of valuable inputs into how to go about doing this. And last but not least, the three panelists for today. So with that, I'm going to hand this off to Jenny Kwan to take us forward from here.
Great. Thanks, Deepak. So I also want to echo his thanks to Juan, who also helped to organize this, and Deepak, of course, for your guidance. So the roadmap for today is the idea for this session is ways to engage students that complement the case study method, and to kind of increase their engagement and attention and the learning and retention of concepts. Nathan and I, you know, when we were trying to figure out what we might like to do, what we realized was that even though we have very different types of students, they share, you know, some really key characteristics. So I'm at Cal State Monterey Bay. More than half our students are the first in their family to attend college. They are more than half are underrepresented minorities. These are people who are working full time, often at low paying jobs. And so, you know, they're really a very different set of students than Nathan gets. He's getting executive education students that he is teaching. They are also working full time, but he teaches Monday through Friday, 8 to 5 for a week. So it's highly concentrated. And here's what our students share. They don't do the homework. They don't have time to do the reading. And so we are looking for ways to teach this in this kind of environment. And we realize that despite, you know, kind of polar opposite types of students, we have the same pedagogical challenges. So we have a really great panel that we are looking forward to hearing from, who are going to be talking about these different kinds of different ways to teach that accompany and supplement and complement the case study method. So we'll hear from each of them. They'll have about 8 minutes of presentation, and then we'll do Q&A for each one after each presentation. So Nathan, I will let you take it away from here.
Great. I'd love to introduce our panelists. By the way, you know, Jenny, I was reflecting that, you know, you and I kind of occupy different ends of the spectrum, myself at INSEAD with executives, and then you with these kind of students who are working and trying to balance things. But even those of you in the middle, I was really happy to see Scott Livinggood here. We actually did an MBA together, and I remember during our MBA, there were students who would play video games during class. And if you think that back then students could be disengaged, and now all the temptations that are offered to them by social media and even the changing demographics, the question is, and also that people have different learning styles. I mean, I think some of us learn in different ways and it sinks in a different way. The question was, gosh, how do we expand our repertoire? So please really do listen carefully to our guests and be ready to ask them questions. So we're very grateful to have Itai Stern from INSEAD. Itai and I both became professors this summer. So congratulations, Itai. Itai teaches in the MBA, EMBA, and executive programs at INSEAD. He's based in the Fontainebleau campus. One thing that makes Itai unique is he really is the academic director and founder of our immersive learning initiative, which you'll hear about today, using virtual reality tools to teach. But his research background is more on social and psychological processes to understand decisions. So thank you, Itai, for being here. We're also very excited to invite Liz Adair. Here's joining us from Cal State Monterey. And she teaches principles of management, organization, OB, kind of all that great stuff that we love, but really focuses her research on leadership, work and family interfaces, emotion in the workplace. So a really important kind of research background as we think about immersive learning, which is trying to engage not just the mind, but also the emotions, the physical body. And she did her PhD at Minnesota fairly recently. So we also kind of get that fresh perspective. And then finally, Mike Leatherby, who did his PhD at Stanford. We came out of the same program, but is now in Chile. And he was a startup founder. He studies entrepreneurship. He's the president of Startup Chile's advisory board, international advisory board. But one thing I also know about Mike Leatherby's research is that he studied these really trying to teach entrepreneurs principles and apply them. So I think he has depth both in his research and how do you get practitioners to apply principles, but then he also brings that into his teaching. So very excited to have all of you here. Itai, would you perhaps like to kick us off with your discussion about virtual reality and immersive learning?
So thank you, Itai, Nathan. Before you start sharing slides, can we take a minute to just take a picture of the entire group here? So those of you who are participating, if you could turn on your webcam for...
This is the group photo moment, the group photo moment of the Zoom world.
I don't know how to get everybody on one screen, so Deepak.
I have them all on my screen.
I've got it, but I'm waiting for more people to turn on their webcam so that we have a screen populated with pictures and as opposed to just people's names. Come on, surely more of you can turn on your webcam. I'm still waiting for what is it, like six or here's seven the pressure. People.
Yeah. Deepak's. He's going to cold call you.
So the people who know me know to expect it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Elisa, thank you. It's good to see a lot of familiar faces as well. Scott, Sharon, Anthony. That's very cool. All right. Three more. Come on, help us out here. Time to call.
That's exactly how I do it. If a screen is black, those are the first people I do call on during our Zoom calls. And they know that. So it is amazing how quickly that gets people to pop it on, but looks like we're a little bit slower.
I'm thinking about friends I know. Xavier is here. I see Richard Wang is here.
Mm-hmm. Come on, Richard.
On the cold call principle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Richard. It works. One more person.
Nice, Richard. Nice. We got you, Richard.
All right. So everyone, this is the candid camera moment. All right. One, two, three. I think that worked. Let me just make sure that did, and then we'll be off to the races.
This is going to be the best photo STR ever posted. Thank you, everyone.
Excellent. Thanks a lot. That's perfect. All right.
All right.
Let's get back to business then.
Yep.
Okay. I hope you can all hear me.
Yes.
Yep.
Now you're on mute.
Okay. I guess we got disconnected exactly as I was supposed to start.
That's a great teaching lesson.
Thank you so much for Zoom for doing this. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, and can you see my screen?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, wow, good. So thank you so much for inviting me. I'm Itai, I'm a strategy professor at INSEAD, a colleague of Nathan, and I'm very happy to be here. I don't know how I'm going to say everything I would like to tell you. I'm in 8 minutes, but I will try. I will start by saying that I'm a frustrated professor in a way.
There is something covering the top of your presentation, if you can move it. Yeah, there's sort of a bar there. Here we go. And now it's even more. It's even more. Yeah, perfect.
Now you're good.
Okay, so I would say that I'm a frustrated professor, and one of the reasons I am frustrated is because many of us tell our students to disrupt their own industries, while I've realized years ago that we are working in an industry that has never been disrupted. We are teaching more or less in the same way that people always taught, and that is a person conveying knowledge, providing knowledge in a one-way passive kind of a method to someone who is supposed to sit there and passively observe the knowledge. Those are our students who are playing video games when Nathan was doing his MBA. Today, we might do this via Zoom and using wonderful PowerPoint presentations, but ultimately, it's exactly the same. And the problem is that we know that it doesn't work. If you remember about 20% of what you heard in a lecture, you've probably been to a lecture that was given by someone who is really good on a topic which is very close to your heart. So I've always tried to bring in some other things. And about 5 years ago, I've realized that VR technology has reached a point where we can probably use it to bring it into the class. And to bring it into the class in the business school, that means to try to take the case study method, which has always been better than just a passive way of teaching, into its next level. And by that, I mean the vision, the initial vision that we had was that instead of asking people to imagine themselves as protagonists in a case, rather to become the protagonist in the case. How do we do this? We do this using virtual reality. That allows us to overcome a couple of the major challenges that we have in cases that we've already discussed a little bit, the inability to bring in subtle dilemmas and nuances, the ability or inability in cases, but the ability in VR to convey tension, human emotions, then of course, lack of compliance. As we have said, across the board, very few people now read the long cases before coming to class, and it's hard to engage students with them. More and more students are losing their attention spans. There's no attention span anymore for some of them. How do you really keep them engaged? The way that we have been doing it in the last 5 years at INSEAD is by using virtual case studies. Again, instead of asking people to imagine themselves as a protagonist in the case, we make them to protagonist. And by so doing, they are fully immersed. They experience the case itself. And that allows us to be much more effective in our teaching.
These are fundamentally path-breaking technologies that offer a new medium through which we communicate information.
This is a different way of learning. It's much more real life than the traditional case studies. What I found very valuable is the multitude of information that was available if we go and look for it.
Case very cleverly taught us how to analyze different information points, make a complex decision, and work well in a group.
I use VR in my class. Students are much more engaged than just using the traditional way of teaching. They were able to understand more in depth the concepts that we have learned.
I would really appreciate your take on this.
The the research side is so important to have a community of scholars bringing together teaching and research in extended reality.
INSEAD has made it really easy to start applying this in the classroom. There are lots of tools, content, techniques that'll help me start dabbling and adopting these technologies to further my educational goals.
So, as you could have seen here, we are looking for, and today is part of why we're doing all of this, we are looking for partners. At INSEAD, we have produced about 30 VR experiences thus far, which gives us a lot of different advantages, but we still know that we cannot do it on our own. And we have started to build up a consortium. We have about 60 different business schools around the world that are at different stages of using the joining the consortium, and we'd like you to join it. If you join us, you'll be able to have experiences in class that I would argue are much more effective. You learn by doing instead of just hearing or imagining. There is a strong sense of presence. The impact is much greater. We already have some anecdotal evidence to show that people retain much more of the knowledge and know what they're doing with it. There is undivided attention. You get students to be in the headset and they are just there. They are yours to teach. A lot of deans have asked us, but this is expensive. I tell them, actually, it's not. The VR headset that we use is about $300 a headset, a little bit more with the software, but still, it saves us a lot. We don't take people on bus tours to see production facilities or to go places as we did before. And overall, when you look at the outcome, we are actually starting to save money rather than spend money. And then something we won't have enough time to get into today, but a lot of what we do is data-driven. We collect a lot of data about how the decisions that the students make while they are within the virtual environment, while they are experiencing the VR case. We know where they are looking at. We know it, the sequence within which they are operating, and many, many other types of data that then, of course, we use in the classroom to teach. So in other words, instead of sitting and standing in the classroom and telling people, let me tell you something about research and what it tells us, I tell them, hey, how about we analyze your own behaviors, your own decisions, and learn from them. There are many, many different type of experiences, as I say, that we have in our library, which I'm going to show you in a minute. But just to try to imagine it and invite you to come and see it, one of my favorite cases is a case that was recently produced, led by a team of people, by Nathan Furr, who is here with us today, of course. And Nathan, thank you for allowing me to present this one. Really my favorite one, I think, because it allows me to do something really great. I've had a lot of students in the past, both at the degree programs and executive education, that have come to me with a question, if we come to INSEAD, would that help me to understand how to make my organization more sustainable? Would it help me make my organization more innovative? Now, there are a lot of frameworks and models and ideas that can be presented in class, but it's very difficult to do that. Now I know that many of our professors at INSEAD, using this case, where the participants work together with Dan Berber, one of the world's most celebrity chefs. And what they do there, they experience how Chef Berber has actually managed to turn his own organization to be much more innovative and much more sustainable. He wanted to follow many ideas that have been developed before him about from farm to table. But while he was doing it, it realized that that doesn't really address the problem of sustainability well enough, as he would like to see it. It's not It's maybe a bit sustainable, but it's really hard to kind of take it into the, it's not as impactful as you wanted. I'm not going to tell you all of it. You can go in and read a lot about this while you will be doing it with the chef. You'll be able to see how the chef is working with his team, how he's sourcing all of his supplies. You'll be to see and experience all of the ecosystem. And as all of our cases, you can use this really fascinating, it's much different about reading about a kitchen, let me tell you, and standing in the kitchen when a lot of things are happening around you and you need to make decisions and you need to understand how to drive and do things. It's much more exciting. People remember exactly what you do. And I've seen people use it for innovation. People that use it for sustainability, people use it for ecosystems. So there are a lot of ways of doing this. Now, where can you find this case and many others? You can find this in our library. And you're going to see now on the chat the URL that you're welcome to go in, see the portal that we had to develop and to be able to bring in a lot of cases. Our vision is that all of us continue to produce cases together. You'll be able to upload your own material, download others' material, teach their material and so forth. As I said, we have about 60 business schools that are in the process of joining this consortium. This is an open invitation for you to join it as well. All of the information on the portal. We also, one more thing before I answer questions, that we had to develop. A lot of people tell me, but this is probably very difficult to do. 4 years in which we made many mistakes have brought us to the point where today we have a dashboard that for the professors, for you, that actually works amazingly well. Going into the classroom now is almost, and using VR is almost like playing a YouTube video. Everyone is in the headset. In front of you, you can see what you see as a professor right now. You can see all the headsets that are ready. You can see the different experiences that you want to play in the headset. You're getting a lot of feedback from it, which you can bring into your PowerPoint presentations and use them. There's a lot to explain, a lot to say, but the message is that it really makes learning much more impactful and effective and fun. And to be honest, also a lot very fun to teach. It's a joint effort. There are a lot of people who are engaged, as you've already seen in the video. And if you're interested, please let us know. We'll be more than happy to do it with you. If you want, you can also take a quick look at the QR or use the QR. It will send you into the portal where you can find a lot of other information.
Great, thank you. Questions that you have for Itai? We also have Alon here who helped, who leads this, the development of, and the organization, so he can also answer questions.
And feel we only to- have a couple minutes because I know Itai has to leave and we have two other speakers, but there's a couple in the chat.
Let's take a quick look.
So Scott, do you want to go ahead and just ask your question? It's a great one.
Yeah, I think Alon kind of mentioned this too, but instead of just maybe going to companies, kind of replacing that, but I teach an international business and strategy course. Obviously, the cost of taking students abroad to understand and be exposed to the nuances and complexities of international context is very expensive. This seems to be kind of a good maybe compromise or replacement for that, especially from a cost perspective. Do you have modules and is the software there to kind of replace international experiences to get maybe cultural differences or resource differences or opportunity differences that might exist abroad?
So yes, hi Scott, and thank you. Great question. And the answer is absolutely yes. I'll start from the very simple one. I have a colleague who used to take his students to a production of lean production facility, 2 hours bus drive from the INSEAD campus. And when you get there, you never know what's going to happen. Now we have filmed an experience for him over there. he never took students on a bus ride ever again. And the reason, not only because it saves, of course, the bus ride and the whole day, when you get there, usually you don't know what's going to happen. In the VR, you know exactly what's going to happen, and that allows you to actually enhance the learning. For example, send students into somewhere, and we have a lot of experiences we've done in countries like Cape Verde, in Tanzania, and Singapore, in places that are, in the US, of course, that are far for many of us. And then you can even compare and contrast, send the person into this location, ask them some questions, they don't know how to answer them, then you take off the headset, you come back into the class, they learn some model, they learn some framework, they go back into space and in time, you can do it in VR. And now they need to kind of go through the process again. And at this point, reflection already happens. By the way, as you go to a lean production facility, now you can all also from your home, move from a lean production facility in France to Japan to Michigan and compare them. So there's a lot of things there. So we start with what we call site visits, exactly as you said, and we have those from all around the world, all the way to just, you know, cases where instead of when you can go into a company and you walk around and you interview people and you talk with them, it's very interactive, all the way to simulations that can take even up, you can run them from anywhere from 3 hours to 2 days, where we are taking our students on a mission to Mars. And of course, as you're in a fully embedded in a space shuttle, a lot of different things happen and you need to make decisions with your teams and you get feedback and it's customized because you can, depending on the decision that you make, it would send you into somewhere else and so forth. So it's really, it's endless. But again, as I said, to be really make this much more impactful, we are hoping that many of you would join us in this undertaking. And this is what we're trying to do here.
Thank you, Itai. And Scott, I love the question. So thank you, Itai and Alon, for your time squeezing us into your schedule. And I think we can go on to our next speaker. So yeah, and I know you also have to leave. So thanks so much.
So thank you very much, everyone. And please, again, go into the portal. And if you want to continue the discussion, let us know. We'll be happy to.
Thank you, Itai. Thank you, Alon.
Bye-bye.
So, Liz, would you kick us off on the cool stuff that you do?
Yes. One second here. I think I've got my share ready. Okay. There we go. All right. Can we see?
Yes.
Is it perfect? All right. Well, thank you guys for inviting me. That's a tough act to follow. My talk will be a little more simple, less technological, but still hopefully helpful to you. So I don't teach strategy per se, but I am an organizational behavior scholar, and I do dabble in strategy in my principles class. But I do note that we mentioned early on, we all have some of the same issues with student engagement in the classroom. We tend to do a lot of things. We do cases, we do teamwork, we do discussions. And if you guys are like me, I hear a lot of crickets in my classroom when I ask questions. And so one thing I think that could be helpful is working to enhance our concept of psychological safety. So I'm going to talk about an activity I do in my class, a simple activity that anyone can do. And I've seen major changes in my students' engagement participation. So what is, let's see if this, here we go. So what is psychological safety? This is a concept put forth by Amy Edmondson, a scholar at Harvard Business School. And this is the idea that when we're in a group of people, we won't be punished for making a mistake or being wrong or having really radical ideas. We're safe from bullying, from being ostracized, things like that. It provides us the ability to be authentic, and it allows moderate risk-taking, people to speak their mind, to be creative, and to kind of stick your neck out, as we say. And for students, this is important because if they don't feel safe in the classroom environment, they're not going to speak up. They're not going to voice their opinions. And from my experience, I've noticed this is a big issue with a lot of my students. They're shy. They don't know each other very well. So what does psychological safety look like? This is a measure I use from CAPME, which is a team-based platform to manage teamwork. It measures psychological safety in teams. So I just have this here to illustrate kind of what it looks like. If you make a mistake on the team, it's often held against you. That's reverse scored. Members of the team are able to bring up problems and tough issues. It's safe to take a risk on this team, all that kind of stuff. So it captures people's ability to speak freely, take risks. Now, psychological safety is not about being nice. It's not about hugging everybody and being mushy. It's not about that. It's okay to argue with people, to disagree. And that's part of the psychological safety culture. So Dr. Edmondson kind of had every researcher's dream come true when she put forth this concept of psychological safety. And Google did a big study where they were having some issues with their teams, and they realized some teams just really thrived and others did not. And they kind of tested everything under the sun. And what they found, they looked at diversity, they looked at team composition, all kinds of different things. But the number one predictor of whether or not groups thrive at Google was psychological safety. And Dr. Edmondson also has a nice little format here that kind of shows the learning zone. And this is contrasting goal demandingness, or the level of goal demandingness, to psychological safety. So what we see here, if we give students a really not undemanding goal that's not challenging at all, and they have low psychological safety, they have what we call apathy, right? They're not challenged and they don't feel safe speaking their opinions, so they become apathetic. The comfort zone happens when we have goals that are less demanding but high psychological safety. We're just comfortable with each other. We're not really doing anything. The anxiety zone happens here when we have low psychological safety but high demands on our goals. So we have these big challenges we have to face, but we don't feel comfortable sharing. We're scared to kind of talk and to express ourselves. So that causes a lot of anxiety. And this is kind of what I see in the classroom pretty frequently. And then we have the learning zone. And this is where we push people, we challenge them, but they feel safe to make mistakes and take risks. And that's where we want our students to live, is in this learning zone. So why do we care about this for class? What I've noticed is through my work on enhancing psychological safety, I have better discussions. My students feel more comfortable speaking up, taking risks, saying things that maybe aren't correct. We have smoother teamwork. We have enhanced decision-making and innovation because they're able to take risks and play with ideas without feeling like they're going to be criticized. I have better engagement with my students. And then it's a way to improve networking too, as people feel more comfortable with each other. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. A few ways to do it. First of all, we can measure psychological safety. And I recommend doing that along the way throughout the semester if you have semester-long teams. Asking for feedback on delivery of feedback, which sounds weird, but can you give me feedback on my feedback? Is it hostile? Is it that kind of thing? Replacing blame with curiosity. So instead of saying, you did this wrong, I say, why did this happen? What can we do differently? Anticipating reactions and planning counter moves, approaching conflict as a collaborator and not an adversary. But the key pieces right here are the last bullet, speaking human to human. And this is recognizing that people are similar to you. They're a human like you. And self-disclosure, both of those things are shown to enhance psychological safety. So this small activity I do is called self-disclosure poker. And I always play it anytime I put students into new teams. And it's a way just to get them talking about themselves, opening up, and really enhancing that psychological safety. I do want to give credit to my old professor from my MBA program, Dr. Miller at Texas State University. This was his idea, and I kind of tweaked it and made it my own. So I wanted to give him some credit for that. So here's the overview. You put the students in a team. You give each team a deck of cards. They shuffle the deck. They place it in the center. Each team member takes turns disclosing something interesting about themselves and drawing a card in return. So you don't deal them out. They just say something interesting. What we see is through the norm of reciprocity is that as people start to share deeper and more personal things, other people tend to follow and do that, which really enhances psychological safety. After they draw five cards, they can continue sharing facts to swap out one card at a time to try to get a better hand. If this is all time permitting, you can adjust to make it fit whatever time you have. The best hand in each group wins. The winners share anonymously the most interesting and least interesting facts they've heard. And I often have a little prize for the student with the best hand in the class, maybe a Starbucks gift card or something like that, just to kind of motivate them to want to do well. And I also sometimes say if it's an even number group, like teams of four or six, I would say, you know what, the winner is the tiebreaker for the rest of the semester. You've got tiebreaking privileges or something like that. So a couple more rules. One fact for one card. They can't swap cards with other players. They try to do that too. But most importantly, teams can veto uninteresting facts and demand a new one. I don't care that you're a marketing major. That's not very interesting to me. I want to hear something better. And so the team has that power to veto a fact and say, no, you can't get a card for that. You have to tell me something better. Something more personal and interesting and fun. And I always have this on the board. This is a nice little outline of the different hands that they can have. I'll have a handful of students who are familiar with poker. Most of them are like, I have no idea. And so I have to kind of help them figure out who's the winner. And I have other students that do that as well. And so they can kind of follow along and see how they're doing. I have a couple other quick alternatives and ideas. I often do a Mentimeter survey beforehand. When I put them in a group, I say, how comfortable are you with this team? And ask them questions about that. How much do you trust your team? We do this activity, then I talk about psychological safety. All right, we do this activity, then I measure it again. And then we talk about psychological safety and why all of this stuff happened. There's also, you can add another layer by giving teams 5 to 10 minutes to find as many things that they have in common as possible outside of work or school. So to make it really personal, see which team can find the most. And we can also use it as a networking blitz. I've done this before where we just mix up a bunch of different teams, have them play, mix them up again. And this is where they're getting to know their peers in the whole classroom, which can really foster classroom level psychological safety. So I'm not sure how I am on time, but that's all I got for you. Feel free to message me or email if you have any questions. And thanks for listening. Oops, that's not what I wanted to do.
We are short on time. There's a couple of questions in the chat list, so maybe you could do that. And then we could push on to Mike and take questions at the end if we have time.
And I can help Liz to process those. So there's a question from Angie that says, I'm curious how a classroom environment that fosters psych safety is reconciled with a course that also evaluates and grades students on mastery of material. Do you see any conflict between grading practices and psychological safety in the classroom?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's something That comes down to course design and how we design our assignments and what we're actually grading. Are we grading mastery? Are we grading? And I, for me personally, when I have discussions in the classroom, I don't grade you on if you're being accurate in your discussion. What I really am interested in is that you're participating, that you're thinking deeply, and that you're sharing and engaging in the content. It's not necessarily about being right. And that's where I see the biggest opportunity there. Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. And then Scott asked a question around an idea. Maybe could the instructor be involved themselves in some way in this? And he suggested, for example, this could be turned into Texas Hold'em, where the instructor shares an interesting fact that then becomes the community cards for everyone to use to make the best.
I like that. That's really creative. Yeah, there's a lot of different like tweaks and stuff you could put on this activity. Yeah, I think that's really creative. I kind of share stuff about myself early on in the semester, but I think tying myself into the game would be a good way to kind of get them engaged too. But the whole time they talk, they laugh, they, you know, like they're having a really good time and really getting to know each other. And the scores are always higher afterwards on how comfortable they feel and how much they trust their team and that kind of stuff. So yeah. Thank you guys for your thoughts and comments and questions.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Liz. Why don't we transition to Mike for the sake of time? We'll share a little bit about what he does with his workshops.
Thanks, Nathan. Can you hear me well? Can you see the slide?
I can hear you and see your slides.
Excellent. Well, thanks again for the opportunity to discuss some thoughts and ideas around the Lean Startup Method as a tool for activity-based learning. And I'm particularly interested in this method for a few reasons. Firstly, it became popular when I was in the middle of my PhD. And so I was lucky to be invited by Rita Catilla to join a research initiative for the iCORE program. That, to the best of my knowledge, was the first public policy to apply the method widely to large numbers of technology-based startups. My 2020 paper in SCJ used this setting, which I will briefly talk about shortly. The second reason is this idea that you can follow a recipe to reduce the uncertainty of your business ideas is theoretically appealing to me. Of course, as scholars have delved into this topic, we have learned about the nuances of this general idea, which I will briefly also talk about during the following minutes. And thirdly, I'm the academic director of an innovation and entrepreneurship course at the School of Engineering at Pontificia Universidad Católica de Chile. And it's a course that is mandatory for all of our 800 students every year. And we rely heavily on the use of the Lean Startup Method in this course. This course is very similar in nature to the experience entrepreneurs get in a business accelerator. In the sense that they have to discover their opportunities or prepare the ideas and then defend these ideas in a competition at the end. And the winners get money so that they can pursue their ideas. And so not only do I have particular interest in understanding the effects of the method on the student outcomes, I have the chance to observe their predisposition to the method and to some degree how the method shapes the way they think about and imagine and choose business opportunities. So I'll also share my general impressions and intuitions about this. So let's begin. Very broadly, the purpose of the Lean Startup Method, also known as the scientific method for entrepreneurs, is to reduce the uncertainty about business opportunities and their business models. So you've got, imagine you have a hunch about how a specific potential customer or set of customers would appreciate a given value proposition, and that the best way to build a competitive position is through a given strategy. Okay. So the method, the method prescribes that entrepreneurs make explicit their assumptions, that their hypotheses about those elements in the business idea. and the business model, about those elements that they are unsure about, right? So next they need to think about ways to learn whether their hypotheses are valid or not. And so the most common approach is to, quote unquote, get out of the building and interview potential stakeholders and customers. So in our SEJ, all this hypothesis probing. Now, in principle, this approach makes sense. You come up with a creative idea about an entrepreneurial opportunity, and naturally there will be a lot of uncertainty in that idea. So you should thus do what you can to reduce that uncertainty. So if your hypotheses are correct, you have effectively reduced the uncertainty about your idea and improved your confidence that you are on the right track. In contrast, if your hypotheses are wrong, the sooner you know about it, the less time and resources you will waste pursuing unrealistic dreams, right? So it makes sense. Now, there's a third possible outcome that is less discussed. So let me just go back a second. And so you learn and you can either desist or persevere, or they call it pivot also, which is you kind of decide to change your idea. But let me go into what is going on in that pivoting. And this is where it's less discussed, in my opinion. And so it's the path of inspiration. So as you work to learn about the validity of your hypotheses, you may bounce into or become primed to imagine a new opportunity that you may have never come up with otherwise. So sort of like Alexander Fleming, when he discovered the penicillin, right? He was doing all sorts of experiments in his lab, and he observed a phenomenon in his Petri dish that was inconsistent with his prior hypothesis about how natural systems work. You know, that is the growth of mold in his dirty Petri dish. His hypothesis is that growth of mold should not have occurred. And so, in fact, precisely what we find in our SEJ paper is this moment of inspiration, or this mechanism of inspiration. And so what we find is you have this process where you formulate the hypothesis, you go out and test the hypothesis, and then you can converge towards whether or not your idea is a good idea or not. But what we find here is that the more efforts people put into hypothesis probing, the more likely they will come up with new ideas that they hadn't considered before, and therefore formulate new hypotheses to test. And so I think this is one of the more interesting insights in the paper, that is, you know, the prescription to get out of the building not only can help you see if your idea is reasonable, but also helps you to discover new ideas that only emerge when you collide your ideas with the ideas of other people. Now, what about the performance enhancing effects of this method? I would argue that one of the more solid pieces of evidence that the Lean Startup method improves venture performance is a randomized controlled trial conducted by Kabufo et al. This was published in Management Science in 2020. And what they find is that the treatment group received, basically they had a treatment group and it received specific training on how to make explicit their hypotheses and design experiments to validate them. And the performance differences in favor of the treatment group were quite impressive. However, like all tools, it's important to understand the boundary conditions. In my opinion, Felling et al.'s 2020 paper in the long-range planning provides convincing arguments about potential pitfalls or concerns regarding using this method. For example, that the feedback from customers can cause entrepreneurs to converge towards obvious or non-innovative opportunities. We have all probably heard of highly successful ventures that are described as ludicrous and surely to fail when they are starting. Of course, it's not always easy for people to wrap our heads around ideas that are radically different to how we see the world. So the feedback that we may give entrepreneurs may actually push them back towards the norm rather than encourage further exploration of radical ideas. So that's why I believe we need to teach entrepreneurs how to use this lean startup method properly, this tool, right? For example, Felin and colleagues, they emphasize the importance of developing a solid theory about the opportunity and carefully choosing those hypotheses on which it's worth to spend time on. And in this sense, I agree that rushing into a testing hypothesis about business ideas with customers when you do not really know what you want to do is probably not such a great idea. And this is one of my biggest concerns with our 800 students who take the entrepreneurship class each year. We're basically asking them to go out and interview 20 stakeholders to validate or invalidate their hypothesis when they are just starting to figure out what are the key features of what a robust business opportunity really looks like. So, you know, I have my concerns about that method applied in this case. And so, and just to wrap up, lastly, I would like to add this other paper by Matt Grimes, published in 2018 in AMJ, that looks at how to react to feedback. So, you know, you could say one extreme is to do exactly as people tell you, everything, all the feedback you get, you do exactly what they say. The other extreme is to just resist all feedback and say, you know what, I'm going to ignore everything everybody's telling me. I'm going to keep doing whatever I want. And I agree with Matt Grimes's prescription that there's probably a sweet spot in the middle where entrepreneurs should think carefully about the underlying rationale of the feedback and then later make a decision about whether it is worth doing something different based on that feedback. So to the extent that we can teach students about how to use this tool, I think it will be more effective in its use. So I'll leave it at that and open up for questions.
Mike, we would really love to hear more about how you help students, how you actually do that with students. Like, what does it look like? The how of, not so much kind of the findings, but like, how do you teach students? What do you do? How do you set it up? How long is it? How many, you know, give us some of that black art of how you do that, you know, the hidden knowledge of how you do that.
Right. So students begin the class and they are basically required within the next 2 weeks to go out and interview people about their ideas that they have, right? And they need to report on what they learned and then also present to the professors, the teachers, what kind of interesting insights they got from these, what hypotheses were validated, which were invalidated. And what is challenging, in my opinion, is to get them to actually come up with really wild ideas. There's a convergence towards, you know, going down into, you know, I don't know if to call it easy ideas or easy or kind of obvious opportunities. And one of the things I've been thinking about carefully is how can we get them to be super creative and not become discouraged when they go out to talk to potential customers with their creative ideas and their customers or potential customers or stakeholders say, that's a ludicrous idea, you know, that's never going to work, et cetera, et cetera. So I do not have the answer to how to keep that creativity levels high given that context, because I do believe there's value in not only going out and talking to people and kind of getting out of building a classroom. I think there's value in that, definitely. There's also value in understanding how the tool works, how the method works. But there's this kind of tension between, you know, to what extent is the tool actually hindering this imagining these crazy creative ideas. Not sure if that answers the question, Nathan. That's specifically with the use of the Lean Startup Method. Now, I can talk to you a little bit about the course. As I mentioned before, it's based on this accelerator principle. So they've got mentors in the middle and they need to present. And then we have external judges that evaluate their projects and give them a grade. And then the winners, you know, we select 15 of the 70 projects each semester we select the top 15 and they need to present in front of potential investors. So they get a real feeling for what it is to start a venture, deal with partners, understand what is a value proposition, how to persuade potential investors about their ideas. And then the end, as I mentioned before, the winners get some cash to continue with their projects. Still right. Several questions to answer, though.
Deepak actually asked about he said, do you also have some suggestions or experience about how this would work with business managers and larger firms? Are there differences or nuances we should be aware of?
That's a great question. I think that, so most of my experience using the Lean Startup Method has been in undergrad. And so perhaps some of my concerns about the negative consequences of using the method for undergrads who might not understand what a business opportunity actually is might not apply for the case of managers who have experience with strategy, understand what strategy actually looks like. So I'm just going to hypothesize here for a second that maybe the method, the drawbacks that I envision that the method can have might not apply to people who have much more experience, right? But then that's just a hypothesis.
You know, Mike, just sort of pedagogically, you talked about the external judges. And so I've also tried that with my class as well. And it actually changes the instructor's role from being the grader, you know, the person who's going to judge students, to being the student's partner in getting them ready for the external judges. So I think that is also another way to shake up, you know, the kind of standard classroom format.
Right. No, it's and so what we have in the classroom, it's a kind of expensive course in the sense that we have each class is relatively small, it's 50 students. And we have the teaching faculty, but we also have an entrepreneur teacher. So we have two faculty members in each class. Somebody that we bring from outside is an entrepreneur, has experience. And then we have TAs, three TAs in each class, which also is a high number in our case. And so it's a very hands-on initiative. It's an irrelevant investment that the School of Engineering is doing in this specific course for our students. So, yeah.
Well, I think that pretty much concludes our time. And I want to thank a special thanks to our panelists, Mike, Liz, and Itai for all of your insights. And thank you everybody for coming. We're really grateful for your time and your engagement. Look forward to continuing the conversation.
It was great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you all.
Thank you all.